Blog Talk Radio.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Well, it's that time of year. We hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving and a great Christmas holiday coming up. And we're going to play one Christmas carol at the beginning of each one of our episodes until Christmas. Last week, we had a great presentation about D.B. Cooper and such an interesting story still being played out. And we didn't get a chance to read the entire letter that was supposed to be been written by D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper, as he called himself when he checked in at Northwest in Portland, at the Portland airport. Here's what the letter read, which we did not read last week. We wanted to make sure we read that this letter, and then we'll go into our program. D.B. writes, "I knew from the start that I wouldn't be caught. I didn't rob Northwest Orient because I thought it would be a romantic, heroic, or any of the other euphemisms that seem to attach themselves to situations of high risk. I'm no modern-day Robin Hood. Unfortunately, I do have only 14 months to live. My life has been one of hate, turmoil, hunger, and more hate. This seemed to be the fastest and most profitable way to gain a few fast grains of peace of mind. I don't blame people for hating me for what I've done, nor do I blame anybody for wanting me to be caught and punished, though this can never happen. Here are some, not all, of the things working against the authorities. I'm not a boasting man. I left no fingerprints. I wore a toupee. I wore putty makeup. They could add or subtract from the composite of 100 times and not come up with an accurate description. And we both know it. I've come and gone on several airline flights already and am not holed up in some obscure backwoods town. Neither am I a psychopathic killer. As a matter of fact, I've never even received a speeding ticket. Thank you for your attention, D.B. Cooper. Now, you recall he sent this letter out to several news sources, New York Times, the Seattle and Washington and Portland newspapers and others. And it was never actually released to the public until just a few months ago when the person that has been exploring this fact that the FBI may be wrong. So at any rate, that's the letter as it was supposed to have been from D.B. Cooper. Now, that's all the news that I have from last week, and we hope you'll go back to that episode. It's episode 342, and listen to the entire program. It's a little bit over an hour, I think about an hour and a half, as a matter of fact. So it was fun to do, and we thought we'd just catch you up on that letter. So let's go into our program now and listen to some interesting news that is recent as of this past week.
Breaking news number one. We're sad to say that we heard and read in the newspaper and on articles by Flightlines, Aero-Pacific Flightlines, Aviation Daily, that the DOT, the Department of Transportation, canceled AOC for Eastern Airlines. November 22nd, the Department of Transportation has canceled Eastern Airlines Air Operator Certificate, AOC, thus bringing to close a long-running, some say chaotic, attempt to revive a new name storied in aviation history. DOT, in an order dated November 20th, said it would cancel the certificate authority issued to Eastern Airlines Group Incorporated, authorizing it to engage in an interstate and foreign charter air transportation of persons, property, and mail. Eastern, on November 13th, notified DOT that it would voluntarily surrender its operating certificate to the FAA, and that the carrier did not object to the DOT cancellation with economic authority. The order took immediate effect, although Eastern on any or any interest party had 10 days to petition DOT. Another article said the Eastern Airlines rebirth dream comes to a rapid end by Airways, November 23rd. In Miami, nearly 24 years after the original Eastern shutdown on January 18, 1991, the new Eastern Airlines came back, but not for too long. Following a turbulent start and an even more unstable lifespan, Eastern Airlines has surrendered its Air Operator Certificate, AOC, to the U.S. Department of Transportation, DOT, according to a note released by the DOT organization that would cancel the certificate authority issued to Eastern Airlines Group Incorporated, authorizing it to engage in an interstate and foreign charter air transportation of persons, property, and mail. Eastern Airlines replied to this note saying that they did not object to the DOT canceling its economic authority, waking up to an infeasible dream. The entire articles on that are on the www.ealradioshow.com, Eastern Airlines Group.
Breaking news number two. Airbus envisions autonomous airliners by Mary Grady, November 23, 2017. Airbus has created a new innovation center in Shenzhen, China, near Hong Kong, where it will pursue research that would enable a single pilot to fly commercial aircraft, according to Bloomberg News. Airbus Chief Technology Officer Paul Ehrenmenko told Bloomberg this week, quote, "We're pursuing single pilot operations as a potential option, and a lot of the technologies needed to make that happen have also put us on the path toward unpiloted operations," end quote. Ehrenmenko said a projected pilot shortage drives the research. Airbus said in a news release, the new innovation center will work to accelerate R&D, application, and industrialization of in-flight experience, connectivity, new energy, and urban air mobility, and cultivate an integrated hardware and software ecosystem. See more in newsletter online August to December 17th.
Breaking news number 3, vintage flyers. Lufthansa restores historic aircraft. This was reported by Michael Ross of CNN. While flying is still considered a modern way to travel, many airlines now have clocked up decades of history, and one is taking heritage very seriously. German airline Lufthansa has been restoring the classic examples of its former fleet for displays and experience flights. It's just brought back into service its oldest aircraft in the fleet, a Junkers Ju-52, and is set to recommission the Lockheed L-649A Starliner from 1957. Lufthansa has also been actively been involved in the recovery of a 1970s Boeing 737, known as the Landshut, with an infamous past as a target for hijacking. So what are these stories behind the illustrious old flying machines? You can see more in the newsletter online August through December 17th, 2017. Back to you, Chuck.
Breaking news number 4, Alaskan Airlines to connect Seattle and Pittsburgh. Breaking by Travel News. Alaskan Airlines will add a non-stop daily service between Seattle and Pittsburgh next autumn. The new service is currently the only non-stop flight offered by Seattle-Tacoma International Airport to Pittsburgh International Airport. The new route provides a link from the West Coast to the thriving business community in Pittsburgh, which is continuing to grow as more technology companies look to establish presence in the city. Alaska continues to meet the need of the value of Seattle guests with new service to the Steel City, said John Kirby, Vice President of Capacity Planning of Alaska Airlines. We're pleased to add Pittsburgh to our growing list of destinations from our hometown of Seattle. With an addition of Pittsburgh, Alaska flies nonstop to 90 destinations, which is more than twice as many as any other airline. See more in the newsletter online August, December 17th.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us for our 342nd broadcast tonight. We want to welcome and thank all of our listeners who called into our broadcast to listen. We would love to hear your comments or have you share your memories by saying hi to talk with us on the air live. Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by using their computer and they sign in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you too wish to talk on our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number 213-816-1611 at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Our lines are open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk, we ask you to please mute your phone, as our producer's board does not have the capability of filtering out background noises.
Now, Neil, let's get back to episode number 343, In the Air.
Lockheed L-1011 didn't begin until 1966. Originally, back in 1927, Lockheed had a relationship with Civil Airliners, but when they developed the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar in 1966, it was considered the world's most technology-advanced airliner at that time of introduction. The L-1011 TriStar became their first commercial jetliner and the second wide-body jetliner to be launched.
March 29, 1968, Eastern signed a letter of intent for an order that included 25 firm and 25 options worth $860 million with Lockheed Aircraft. The first L-1011 delivery was in 306 EA. To Eastern on April 5th, 1972. That was my seniority date, by the way. Although the service was not scheduled to begin until April 30th, it entered service on April 26, 1972, when Eastern's first new Lockheed L-1011 flew the New York-Miami flight route with 123 passengers, and Eastern continued its love affair with the Lockheed aircraft. By October, it had 6 226-seat L-1011s in service. Eastern favored the tri-jet configuration as much as their long routes over water was still an era before extended twin-engine operation. Don?
Eastern Airlines was one of the first most prolific operators of the type in which was launched customer along with TWA. Unfortunately for both, they were also the first to lose one of the types shortly after its introduction into service. Unlike the DC-10 accidents of the same era, Eastern Flight 401 was a fault of ambiguous electronics and human error. Nothing that would tarnish the type's overall perception with customers or earn in any erroneous nicknames. Jim?
The 1011 was designed with so much redundancy that there are even some bright spots in its relatively small history of incidents and accidents. In the case of Eastern 935, the quadruple redundant hydraulic system allowed all passengers to walk off the aircraft with nothing more than a few gray hairs. Actually, they lost every hydraulic system, if you study up on that, except one, and it would enable the airplane to be landed using that last hydraulic system. The 1011 was an aircraft that was a bright point in an era of challenging reliability issues. Some A&P mechanics complained about some aspects, such as using a unique type of self-locking screw. Seems to be a minor point. Despite that, the service record was impressive. The 1011 was an aircraft of many firsts and great engineering. It was merely a victim of product positioning and Rolls-Royce's troubles. Look.
Chuck, are you with us?
Yes. I'm there. Unfortunately, its Rolls-Royce RB211 engines were also groundbreaking. Though Rolls-Royce had been working on their signature tri-spool turbofan since 1965, it was the first aircraft to feature this engine. For around $533,000 per engine, Rolls-Royce was offering unheard-of efficiency and thrust, as well as lighter and stronger composite fan blades. However, the composite fan blades led to a massive delay with the engine. It was not enough. A foreign exchange issue was involved. Lockheed's revenue sharing on the project sent Rolls-Royce into bankruptcy. Clearly, they recovered, but the RB211 became one of the most successful turbofan engines, as well as an industry generator. It did, however, delay the L-1011 by 2 years, unheard of in those times. Linda?
To maximize space, airlines tried to utilize lower deck areas of the 1011. The lower galleys were a little more popular, unfortunately. Flight attendants were not a fan of being stuck down below during meal preparation. Regardless, the late 1960s was a time of rapid innovation, and Lockheed was clearly game to try anything to sell a flagging aircraft. On the runway, the Lockheed 1011 TriStar was an undeniable beauty with its large curved nose, low-set wings, and a graceful swept tail. It looked as sleek as a dolphin, but in flight, the 1011 was nothing short of a miracle, the first commercial airliner capable of flying itself from takeoff to landing.
Conceived during the 1960s to transport 250 passengers on popular transcontinental routes, the L-1011 boasted overhead luxuries, including glare-resistant windows, full-size hideaway closets for coats, and a below-deck galley which lifted filet mignon and lamb chop dinners up to the main cabin in two elevators. Passengers loved riding in it thanks to the unique engine configuration that reduced the sound in the cabin. Flight crews appreciated its extra-wide aisles and overhead bins. But the TriStar's pilots, like our own Captain Neil Holland, who had also access to its most thrilling feature, an advanced fly-by-wire automatic flight control system called the AFCS. Over to you, Ken.
Thank you, yep. And Neil remembers, don't you, Neil? All he had to do was to dial the altitude and course changes into the flight control system and monitor their instruments. And the L-1011 would fly and land on its own, descending smoothly onto the runway by locking into an airport's radio nav equipment. And on May 25th of 1972, veteran test pilots Anthony Levere and Charles Hall transported 115 crew members, employees, and reporters on a four-hour, 13-minute flight from Palmdale, California to Dulles Airport outside Washington, D.C., with the TriStar's AFCS feature engaged from takeoff to landing roll. It was a groundbreaking moment, the first cross-country flight without the need for human hands on the controls. Fly-by-wire technology was here to stay. Back to you, Jim.
Thank you. The legacy of the Whistleliner, that was Eastern's nickname for it. Thanks to its impressive autopilot feature, the TriStar was given special clearance by the FAA to land during severe weather conditions. Whereas other wide-body jets had to be diverted to an alternate airport, the 1011 passengers could rest assured that they would touch down precisely where and when they were scheduled to land. Dubbed the Whistleliner, like I said, by Eastern Airlines, quiet takeoff and notable lack of noise in its passenger cabin, the production of the 1011 continued till 1983. The 1011 fleet had a remarkable in-service rate that reached 98.1% reliability. But the financial troubles proved too much to overcome. A total of 250 TriStar jets were produced by Lockheed, and the 1011 marked the company's final commercial passenger airline. But the company exited on a high note, having created, in one pilot's words, the most intelligent airliner ever to fly.
Now, we hope you enjoy the audio that was made from the promotional videos of Lockheed back in the day, back in the 60s. It was first made by Lockheed test pilots and other members of the team designing the aircraft. And I've taken a pretty lengthy promotional video that even Eastern Airlines used. And I've edited most of the extra sounds that really were not related to the story. And we pieced together the following. It's about 10 minutes long, and we'll hear some Eastern folks. As a matter of fact, President Floyd Hall is on this audio portion of this video that was edited for our broadcast tonight. So I hope you enjoy it.
You have to get up damned early in the morning to beat the TriStar. And we in the flight test business want to keep it that way. I'm Hank Dees, your L-1011 project pilot. And we thought you'd like to know a bit of what we've been doing up here in the flight test program.
We begin on the morning of February 16th with the first flight of ship number 2. With Ralph Coakley in the left seat, the flight progressed smoothly without any snags, and we established 10,000 feet and a speed of 300 knots. On February the 24th, we had 2 TriStars flying together. At this time, we had 64 hours and 20 minutes flying time and 26 flights. The first other than Lockheed pilots to fly was Captain Hoshibushi of All Nippon Airlines. During the flight, All Nippon were greatly impressed with the simplicity of our aircraft and the controllability of all systems. Captain Hoshibushi proved the airplane in the air, and he shot his first landings with gusty winds up to 35 knots. Captain Hoshibushi did a very good job of flying the airplane and commented that this is one of the best, simplest airplanes that he has flown. Early in March, Ship 1 was continuing into the performance program and into the flutter program. This onboard data acquisition system with onboard analysis assured that the flight was progressing as planned. The water ballast system enables us to vary CGs to obtain the most out of each particular flight. The flying tail on the airplane has been a joy to fly. On April the 4th, we ferried the airplane to Edwards Air Force Base for an early morning takeoff the next day at the maximum weight the airplane has been in the air. This was 404,570 pounds. You will notice Mr. Weaver wasted no time in pulling the gear this morning. This established the maximum weight in the air and the longest flight on the aircraft to date of 6 hours and 41 minutes. The prime reason for the heavy weight takeoff is that this is a basic configuration in the flutter program. Oscillating vanes on the wingtips put a control frequency into the aircraft to get the structural response of the wings and the airplane. The vanes input approximately 200 pounds oscillating load on the wingtips. The first thing that you do on a new speed is a control pulse input. The pilot hits the ailerons in a real sharp fashion so that you get one fast, sharp control input. The envelope expansion program will be completed in the near future. On April the 27th, we made our first completely automatic landing, a tremendous accomplishment as this was the second flight the autopilot had been engaged. The airplane is intercepting a localizer for a hands-off auto approach. The gear is coming down at this time. We have intercepted the localizer, and we're coming up on the glide slope. Notice the hand placement of Raph Coakley. He is guarding the wheel, but not touching it. And notice how correctly the airplane is tracking the center line of the runway. It is glued right. In this stop, we are applying maximum braking with no thrust reverses. There is good anti-skid action on the left-hand tire, and the airplane is stopped in approximately 2,500 feet from touchdown. The braking system has proved itself to be quite good and very smooth to pilot application. Following its first flight in mid-May, Ship 3 in Eastern Colors was quickly gathering flight time. This time, the combined total was 220 hours on ships 1, 2, and 3. Particular emphasis is being placed on gathering flight time for ship 3, as this is our TriStar at the Paris Air Show. Getting ready was a bit hectic, especially outfitting the cabin, as the number 3 TriStar was the first to have passenger accommodations. As you can see, they've done a beautiful job. For the technically inclined Paris Air Show visitor, the forward section was left in its original flight test configuration, and of course will be used for continuing flight test work. Along with us, Easton was busy in preparing to show off the TriStar and its new uniforms. Picture taking was the order of the day. On June the 8th, Ship 3 returned to Palmdale from the Paris Air Show.
We do think that this is the first of the wide-bodied trijets to land on European soil. And we are most happy to welcome all of you to be with us for this conference this morning. And I'd like to introduce the chairman of the board of Eastern Airlines, Mr. Floyd Hall, and have Floyd say anything that he would like to say to you this morning.
Speaking for our company, this event here today, I think, validates an assumption that we made several years ago, that this airplane with its particular engines would be one of the finest airplanes in commercial service. And we have never lost that faith. We still believe that it will be, when it is in commercial operation, one of the finest airplanes as far as the traveling public here is concerned.
We left the Paris Air Show, as you know. We went to Midland.
10-11 on English soil was an inspiration to roll, and we are assured of their full support. I wonder, after all those people went through the airplane, fellas, in East Midlands, whether there's anything left of the carpeting or not. But if Bob Christie of Air Canada happens to be here, man, we really proved those floorboards, I gotta tell you. They took an awful beating. And how'd you like to take a look at the inside of the airplane? The line forms to your left, and give you an opportunity to go up and take a look at the airplane. How's that?
With the envelope expansion program behind us, we have been conducting stall tests on Ship 1. The airplane has no surprises for the pilot and is smooth in a stall, either in the clean configuration or with the gear and the flaps extended.
Notice the high angle attack, about 22 degrees. Minimum stall speed was approximately 100 knots. FAA stall certification test will begin in November. At Edwards Air Force Base, we began our minimum unstick speed test. With the flying tail, the aircraft can be rotated to a desired angle and held there with no difficulty right through the liftoff. In this run, the fuselage was held within 2 feet of the ground. Further unstick speed test will be run on TriStar 1 with a special tail skid installed. By early July, we had put over 1,000 flight hours on the RB211 engines.
This flight, the 127th flight of the L-1011, we have 1,000 hours RB211 engine time on the L-1011 airplanes. The RB211 engines, the new engines that we have on this airplane now are the so-called 3 pluses, which give us a certificated level of thrust. We're operating this airplane now with the engines to equivalent of the certificated thrust level that we will have when we get a ticket on the engine. The handling characteristics of the engine from a pilot standpoint have been extremely well received by all the guys who have flown the airplane.
We all know the TriStar is quiet, but we had to find out just how it measured up to the FAA noise regulations. With the quiet desert as a background and this sensitive sound recording equipment, we were able to obtain accurate noise level data. Tests show the TriStar to have the lowest noise level of any large jet now flying or expected to fly. This puts it well within the FAA requirements for the 70s and 80s. Ship 2 has been doing extensive cruise performance evaluation with the pre-certification engines rated at 42,000 pounds thrust. In this phase of testing, we look at engine fuel consumption and the efficiency of the engine airframe combination. A lot of performance data for the customer comes out of this kind of flying. In July, TriStar 2 flew to Oakland International Airport for some Autoland touch and goes. On the way up, we went by Moffett Field and LMSC to give the missiles people a look at the L-1011. At Miami, some 4,000 Eastern Airlines people got a special preview of the TriStar, and Captain Mike Finello, Eastern's Vice President of Operations Coordinator, told the press how the 1011 would help their passenger business.
It's just great because we're looking forward to introducing this airplane into our schedules next year, as you know, toward the end of the spring, our first delivery coming in March. We're particularly pleased that we can show it to our employees, show it off to Miami and the state of Florida, being the probably the most advanced airliner to be introduced to this company, the quietest, the cleanest airliner in the sky. So we sort of look upon it as a family airplane.
On the way home, we swung by the Georgia Company, where the 1011's wing was designed and its empennage is built.
Well, that's about it. We have been busy. We've flown approximately 570 hours and 196 flights to date. This leaves us about 1,000 hours of flying before we get our FAA ticket in April. And that's a lot of flying. And as they say, you have to get up early.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that audio part of an edited video, promotional video that was sent out to all the customers or buyers of the L-1011. Of course, TWA and Eastern were right among the first of the purchasers of the airplane, and Eastern, of course, was the first one to fly it in scheduled service. What a wonderful airplane. It's so sad that it's not around any longer, nor is Eastern Airlines. And we want to talk a little bit about our experiences. Some of us on the air tonight have flown that airplane, and we've got some memories, and perhaps we will share a few of those with you tonight. And maybe we've got a bunch of callers. As a matter of fact, several. The board is lit up, so I'm going to open up all the microphones. And if you had the pleasure of flying that airplane, we'd certainly like to hear about it. I'm going to let Jim Holder tell him while we open up the microphones about his experience on that airplane. Then we'll talk to Chuck a little bit and see how Chuck, what he thought about maintaining the engines. And he's got some memories of that, which he'll share. So, Jim, tell us your experience on that airplane.
Well, Neil, I didn't have near as much time on as you did. I think you had over 2,000 hours, and I didn't fly it near that much. But I did fly it quite a bit. And one of my most memorable flights when I was on a new on it, and I was flying with this captain in Atlanta named Sonny Seaman. And Sonny was, I think he was a good old Georgia boy, and he talked like a good old Georgia boy. And we flew this trip to laid over in San Juan, and then the next afternoon, we were going nonstop to Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Well, Sonny flew the airplane into San Juan, and normally, you know, we would flop the legs. And so the next day, we were getting ready to take off heading for O'Hare, and normally, you know, you'd think the co-pilot would make that takeoff, but we were loaded to the gills, full of passengers, full of fuel. It was a very heavy airplane going all the way to O'Hare. And we taxing out, and I said, Sonny, it's not going to hurt my feelings one bit since this airplane is heavy like this, and I'm still sort of new on it. If you want to fly it up there, you're not hurting my feelings one bit. He said, well, Jim, you know, someday you're going to be a captain, and you just need to learn how to fly heavy airplanes as well as light airplanes. So I'd appreciate it if you just take us to Chicago. Well, I did. We pulled out on the end of the runway, and I shut the power up, holding the brakes, and the engine spooled up. It was runway 10, which is the longest runway in San Juan, and I figured we had enough. We had about a 10-mile-an-hour wind on the nose. That helped a little bit. Released the brakes, and that thing took off like a scalded dog. We were going down the runway fast, and I could keep up with everything. And remember, we were full of fuel and full of people. When we passed into that runway, about 300 feet in the air, doing about 400 miles an hour. I know I'm exaggerating just a little bit, but we were hauling behind it. We were hauling behind it. And I made a left turn out, and man, I told Sonny, I said, this is a going machine, man. This is a going machine. Well, we flew on up to Chicago, and it was dark by the time we got there. We've been the daisy chain going around, you know, following another five or six airplanes. But it was dark. I remember that. And we were cleared down to 6,000 feet, you know, following this plane 4 or 5 miles in front of us. And I got to 6,000 feet, and I put the power levers up to maintain the airspeed, and it yawed just a little bit to the right. And I, good Lord, what's going on here, you know? And I looked down at the EPR gauges, which are on the 727 were the main gauges you measured power by, but on the 1011, they weren't as critical. And the gauges for the tapes that went up were by the captain's right knee. And I looked down there, and the tapes for 1 and 2 were up, but 3 was still down at the bottom. I said, Sonny, number 3 engine just quit. And he said, well, Jim, I think it did. Which up one and two up a little bit more, you know. And I said, okay. So I did that. And I don't know what he did, but he started fiddling with that fuel control and messing around. It was dark, you know, and he's over there doing something. Next thing I know, whoop, here's a number 3 inch came back. So we turned and came on in. We didn't tell anybody about it or anything. We came on in and we landed. And Sonny said, well, I think we just better have them boys look at this engine a little bit. So they got out there. They couldn't find anything wrong with it. And they did a run up, you know, went out over the ramp somewhere, and they did a quick run up, came back, said, we can't find a single thing wrong with this engine. So they said, okay, we'll just take it on down to Atlanta then, you know. So we loaded up with people and we flew it to Atlanta and it worked fine. But I don't know what happened, but Sonny did something, figured it out, and he was ripping the fuel control up and down or something. I don't know what he did, but he got it running again. But that was the only time I ever had an engine problem on that airplane. It was a great airplane to fly. It was a, you know, like I said, a scalded dog.
You know, Jim, the all Lockheed airplanes, I believe, are electrical challenges. They seem to have electrical problems that you have to kind of know the airplane and read between the lines in the manual as to how the electrical system works. But I remember that we had a few electrical problems with that airplane. And again, on a night flight from Atlanta to San Juan, I had none other than Julian Betts, who I think was just a genius as far as electrical systems, mechanical systems, or just about any kind of airplane system. And we had electrical systems that the engineer couldn't resolve, and the lights were going on and off, and so he told the engineer, he said, well, why don't you go down in the galley and lower the elevator, go down into the galley and go into the electrical bay area right behind the ovens in the lower galley. And he told him exactly what to do about those batteries in the back, because the electrical system by that time was working on the emergency battery electrical power. And so, golly, I'm glad I wasn't a flight engineer at the time, because I'd never would have gone down and messed around with all those cables, disconnecting one battery and then reconnecting it to another battery. And the engineer did exactly that. And man, that airplane just electrical. It was fixed. And people like that, they really knew the systems. And so that was one of the experiences with that airplane. And I've got a few more, but I want to listen to Chuck tell us about those engines, those RB211 engines. Chuck, what do you got to tell us about that?
There's two things we want to start off with. First of all, the little button that helped you start that engine, he might have used that cold weather switch that sits on the pedestal between the two pilot and the captain. That helps out a lot. When I ran engines up. The second thing is maybe some of you people out there that knew the airplane can tell me what a Messerschmitt rod is. And we'll get to that later. RB211, as we had said before, is a tri-spool engine. That means it has three different types of shafts that run different types of blades. And it's something that was never done before. This was all new to the aviation industry, and obviously this all started way back in the 60s and 69 and worked its way all the way up into, I'd say into the late 1985, probably the 2000 mark, when we had a engine come out. It was called a Rolls-Royce Trent. And the Trent was a 535, and that's an RB211 engine, and it was faster, it was more efficient, it was quieter. It's used today, they call it the darling of the industry, so to speak, because it's doing everything that RB211 was designed to do and Rolls-Royce wanted it to do. Initially, an RB211 only put out probably around 42,000 pounds of thrust. And by the time 89 came around, it didn't accomplish any more than maybe 44,000 pounds of thrust. That's about 1.5 horsepower per 1,000 pounds of thrust. Some of you mathematicians out there can figure out what an engine does. Some of the engines today dwarf this engine by comparison. We've been talking about GE, and it has a new engine that is as big as a house, so to speak, and puts out 150,000 pounds of thrust, so to speak. RB211 has different types of engineering because it was designed, obviously, over in a place called Derby, England, and one of the things that they had produced in it is that big fan that you, when you look inside that engine, and that big, those big blades are attached to the drive shaft. One of those drive shafts, I was telling you, was phenolic, and that's all it was plastic. And unfortunately, that plastic gave them a lot of problems. And as we had quoted before, it cost us 2 years of R&D on that airplane because these parts were not holding up. Eventually, Rolls-Royce went bankrupt, and the RB211 was transferred into the American circuit, so to speak. Actually, we had a build-up and test center in Miami down at the end of the runway that you could go see them build one of these engines. And, of course, then we built them at on the 36th Street in the engine shop. I was privileged to be a manager there for the RB211 section and overlooked about 8 different departments that did different types of work on the engine, just the engine itself. I always liked the engines. I was one of the ground crew, what they call run-up and taxi crew, and I always liked the engine because after a while, you got to know exactly what it sounded like. Mechanics are, you know, they listen to car engines, but later on they listen to airplane engines. And you, from the cockpit, you can tell through the vibration in the airplane and everything how that engine's going. That's how good it was. And you would know that something was good or something was bad or it was just right on target. And most of the time when I ran the engines up and stuff, I never had one bit of problems with it. But we did have the problem with the phenolic hubs until I got straightened out. The new Trent engines that I mentioned before are probably some of the best fuel-efficient engines that they have out today. And it even is fit. They fitted a it's called a Tupelo 2U204. It's a military aircraft by the Russians, and they use an RB211 engine on it, which is unheard of. Which I would say is probably something to be proud of if I was a Rolls-Royce engineer, that the Europeans were using this, and they are using it today. It's for an overall engine it's out there, and the price was a lot cheaper than GE and some of the other engines that are out there. But it developed so much horsepower, so to speak, and for such an economical price that I think that was one of the overriding factors that Frank Mormon and some of the other people decided that was going to go on the L-1011. We could continue on with it. This engine was put on the 747, 757, 767, and some of those are still flying today with that engine on it. So you're talking about a very reliable engine today. It had a rocky start, but it's flying okay today. Back to you, Neil.
Well, I had the pleasure of flying both airplanes that Eastern had that had the RB211 Rolls-Royce engines, and I really enjoyed flying them. Never had any really mechanical problems with the engines, just a few minor ones. Never forced to land because of a problem. Matter of fact, we had loss number 2 because of a fuel filter that blew up in the air 30-some thousand feet, and the captain on that airplane decided that instead of off water from Miami to New York, we would go the inland route. And we arrived in New York without anybody knowing. We did it on two engines instead of three engines. And it took us about 15 minutes longer. That's about it. No big deal. What a wonderful airplane it was. You know, I always compared airplanes, and the 727, I always thought that I could wear it like a glove. And that's the way most pilots that flew that airplane thought about it. And but the 1011, a wonderful airplane. And then I went into the 757, and what a dream come true. The engines on that airplane were just magnificent, as well as the airplane. A wonderful airplane. And so that was my experience on those airplanes, and probably about 4,000 hours in combination on those two airplanes that I enjoyed.
Anybody out there in radio land know what a Messerschmitt rod is for an RB211 engine?
Know what a Messerschmitt is, but not the rod.
It's the same company. What it is, it's a long metal rod that connects the air box to the fuel control box on an RB211. It's like the air coming into your car connecting to the carburetor.
Yeah.
And that's what it's actually called.
Cool.
Somebody told me that when I first started working on it, and I said, "You're crazy. What are you trying to do, kid me?" I says, "I've heard of a Messerschmitt fighter plane in World War II, but I've never heard of a Messerschmitt rod." And I looked it up, and it sure is. Part of the equipment.
Chuck, some of the early delays that we had leaving the gate being delayed was the starting of the engines themselves. We had the APU, which was made by, who was it that made that APU? It's right on the tip of my tongue. Jim Holder, help me out here. Do you remember the APU? It was air something. But at any rate, it just didn't put out enough air, and we were having hot starts all the time, and we had to shut it down, let it cool off, especially if the temperature reached a certain temperature. We had to let it rest for 15 minutes, and if it exceeded that the second time or went over that, we had to wait a half hour to an hour. I forgot exactly the time limits on that, but that caused a lot of problems because it was not just not getting enough air to start those engines. And then some of the captains that I flew with on that airplane actually would push all three start buttons at the same time, and I would look up and I said, "Oh my God, what's going to happen here?" and it seems like one that got the air would be the one that started, and once it shut the valve from that start, it would automatically open to the next one. And I don't know how they did it, but some people felt pretty comfortable on an airplane. But it was a great airplane. Lockheed built a wonderful airplane. And just too bad they didn't build any commercial airplanes after that.
Those three weather switches, I call them cold weather switches, on the pedestal helped start a lot of those problems that you're talking about, because if you could watch the ribbons and you could tell after a while that that engine was not going to start, if you could give it a little more fuel, a lot of times it would catch and spool itself up, and that's what you would do with the cold start engine, the switch.
Yeah,
but you're right. Yeah, they had hot spots and you had to watch them because obviously you could burn the engines up.
Yeah,
but
they
were a
fantastic.
I worked on that plane for years, and it was great.
Yeah. Jim Holder, you had a comment?
Yeah, I was saying I came on the airplane much later than you, and by the time I was started flying it, they had pretty much got all those bugs out and everything. And I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember having a board to start. I mean, every time we tried to start it, every time we started, they started. But like I said, I got on the plane, you know, after maybe 3 or 4 years or something like that. And they had all that all figured out.
Hey, can I ask you a question real quick for Neil or Jim or you guys? Real quick, I know T-Way and other airliners, when they taxied out, they wouldn't start number two until the end of the runway. That's number one, because I want to give everybody else a chance to talk. So just that and a follow-up question. Did you guys ever take off and have an engine failure, either in that aircraft or another one?
I never did take off with an engine failure. I was in the pattern going from Atlanta to Los Angeles, the night flight. You fly all night out there. And we took off out of Atlanta, full load, I think, the best I can remember. I was flying with one of my favorite captains, Captain Gip Guerin. And we were making the turn for the first vector on the departure. And just as soon as we made the turn, a big explosion happened. And the first notice of that explosion, besides feeling the airplane shake, was the flight attendant in the back. What was that?
You know? Oh, my God.
He was on the microphone right away. What was that? Because it was the number three engine, the right wing engine that had let out a – and don't know – I don't ever recall finding out exactly why, but it had had a stall, the engine stall.
Compressor stall.
And compressor stall. And the tower saw it because there was a torch behind that engine. Once it caught, again, it torched just like a welder's torch, except this torch was about a half mile long. And the tower thought we were on fire. Said, and he called and he said, "Hey, Eastern, are you having problems?" That's all he said. Real cool. Are you having problems? and to him, it looked like we were on fire, of course. And, of course, we came back around, landed, and that was the end of that flight on that airplane. But that's about
just
the only major thing that I had. Yeah.
We would have planes come into the overhaul section, that big building on 36th Street. And there was nothing to be done to the plane except wash the soot off the airplane, the wing, and the whole side of the plane all the way up to the tail. And that was because of a stall.
Yeah, compressor stalls. Yeah, they'd let you know about them. And you could see on the 727s and even on the 1011, there was an occasional number two engine compressor stall because it was a center engine, and it didn't take its air directly, like the wing engines take the air directly into the intake of the engine. Instead, on the center engine, you got an S tube that the air has to go in, and it's got little fins that redirect the air so that the air is flowing as smooth as it can flow to the intake of the jet engine that's installed behind that S duct. And so, if you don't get that air flowing, especially on the 727, used to have it all the time, right, Jim Holder?
Well, we had a lot of them, but you know, on the 100, it was an oval shape intake up there. And on the 200 series, they realized that they had a problem, so they actually raised the intake about 3 or 4 inches and made it a circle instead of oval.
Yeah.
And that cured many of those crosswind takeoffs where you might have a compressor stall on number two engine. Ken asked about aborted takeoffs problems, and I had, unfortunately, more than a few. I talked about one out of L.A. that day. I've already mentioned that back on the previous program where we aborted. And I had another one taken off in Atlanta a long time ago where the captain was making a takeoff, and I felt the airplane yaw, and just as we lifted off, and I looked down at the GG key was coming up like a rocket, and I told the captain, I said, "I think we got number three engine that's quit on us here." And we were pretty light. It wasn't a real heavy takeoff. And by that time, the tower said, "Eastern, your number two engine's on fire." And and I remember thinking, I hollered at the captain because I don't want to shut down the wrong engine. I said, he's looking up our tailpipe because we take it off on 1.5. And I said, no, it's not number two, it's number three. Look at here. And the captain agreed, and you know, and we just made a left turn instead of a downwind on 2.7, came right back around. We were in the air probably a total of 4 minutes, and we're back on the ground that quick.
Wow.
But the plane flew great on 2 inches, no problem.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I don't know whether that answers your questions about aborted takeoffs, but I didn't have too many aborted takeoffs, just a few in my career.
Does very much so, and I wanted to give everybody else to get a chance. Well, you know, I was real curious about that number two engine because I wonder why they designed it oval to begin with, because other than the De Havilland Comet or the Vickers Viscount, I've never seen an oval intake on an engine. And I know they changed it, and I always wondered why. And you know what? You guys are great. You answered my question.
Yeah.
So thank you for the airtime, guys.
Well, you know, even the 1011 has a different engine intake, I believe, best I can recall. On the 500 series, where they had that what they call that, the baby carriage or the baby stroller or something like the training wheel. I think it was a training wheel on that L-1011 500 series that was outfitted to fly across the Atlantic. And
like
carrying
a
BC-10? Yeah, it had the training wheel on.
The center gear? I didn't know they would put that on the 1011.
Well, maybe it was on the 10, but at any rate, the 500 series did have a different number two engine design. It was still round, but they had lifted it a little higher on the fuselage, it seems to me.
That's the DC-10.
Yeah, well.
DC-10 is number two engine up on top.
Yeah.
Whereas the L-1011 has what? It's called an S-duct, and those little fins you're talking about are called vortexes.
Vortex.
And the vortex directs the
generators.
Air into the engine.
Vortex generator.
Let me ask Linda. Linda, were you old enough, Linda Fuller, were you old enough to work the L-1011?
No, sir. No.
Okay. I think you had probably already gone by the time you got to the 1011. Yeah. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of flight attendants, and that airplane, the L-1011, was their favorite airplane to work. It was a pleasure.
It was big.
And I think it was because of the roominess. And the pilots liked it because we had a roomy. Lockheed was famous for building wide cockpits for the crew up front. The Electra was a good example of that. A wide cockpit on the DC-9 and even the 727. You're almost shoulder to shoulder with the other guy. But on the 1011 and on the Electra, it seemed like you had a lot of distance between the two pilots. And then you had two jump seats in the 1011. And, of course, you had the trap door that you could go down into the lower compartment, electronic department there in the flight deck.
Avionics Center.
And the avionics center.
Yeah.
And then the hole in the ceiling, I don't know why they ever put that there. Do you know, Chuck, why they put the door in the roof of the airplane?
I don't know. I think it was originally designed something similar to
celestial
the avionics.
Navigation.
The old days, you know, looking at the stars and stuff. That's all we could figure out. I never used it. I never bothered with it.
Yeah.
When I talked to my master mechanic when I was coming up, he says, just leave it alone. If it goes bad, we'll replace it. You know, it's one of those things. Don't bother. Not work. You know, it's working good. And it never bothered me.
Go ahead, Jim.
I was going to say, Lockheed's trying to make up for all those shoulder rubbing Connies that we flew back in the old days. And so you couldn't put a magazine between the captain and the co-pilot on those things. But it was a wonderful airplane. I love the Connies.
Well, you notice I left that out when I said the Electra and the 1011. I didn't mention
the
Connie.
Did not have a wide cockpit. It had a very narrow cockpit.
Yeah.
But it looked beautiful.
Beautiful airplane, the 1011. Wonderful airplane. Had its problems. Instead of Frank Borman bringing it on the property, Floyd Hall was responsible for the purchase of that airplane. And I think it was a good decision on Eastern's part, and it really proved out to be a wonderful airplane, very reliable, and I think made the company some money, except the very early stages of the airplane. So that's our Lockheed L-1011 program for tonight, and hope you enjoyed it. And
it was great. I loved it.
How was your Thanksgiving? Guys, you had a good Thanksgiving, all of you?
You too.
Yes.
Certainly did.
Wonderful.
We had
Jim
a great
Hart?
One. We went down and we saw Ed Slane down at his place down in Fort Lauderdale. He had a nice gathering of all his family and relatives, and he included Don and I. It was just fabulous. So we thank
Neil.
About us.
Yeah, Neil, this is Jim.
Hey, Jim, I was going to ask you, how are you getting along? I know you've gone through some health problems.
Yeah, I'm pretty well along. Thank goodness to the Veterans Administration. They've done a great thing for me. But I wanted to ask regarding the L-1011, how do they perform a stall test?
You know, Jim, if you looked at the video that I took the audio from, I edited the audio sound that you heard and then re-edited about 15 minutes of that to bring it down to about 14 minutes that you just heard. But along with that video, if you'll go into your computer and look up the L-1011 video promotion, that's all you have to put in your browser, you'll actually see that they flew a flight, I don't know which airplane they flew, alongside the L-1011 when it was doing its stalls. And to see that airplane brought up so that it actually did a stall, at least to stick shaker speed, which is just a notch above stall. And the airplane's nose lower down, just like we're trained as pilots to recover from stalls. They did the whole series of stalls on that video. And that's the first time I've seen a large airplane rather than being in them, but from the outside to see what the profile of that stall looked like. And
what
was
the altitude,
beautiful.
Neil?
It was
beautiful. What was the altitude?
They never did mention the altitude, but I would imagine it was probably around 15, 20,000 feet they were doing their stall series.
Oh, okay.
Not much lower than that because it's kind of risky doing that, but it was remarkable, all the tests. And I edited out a lot of the test parts of that video out so you didn't hear it, but I would recommend to go see how that airplane was made. It was and how the test went off
that.
On that airplane. And it's a lot of Eastern, the aircraft 303, I think it was, that went to Paris was the Eastern brand. And it was right alongside the DC-10, McDonnell Douglas, DC-10. And people favored the L-1011 more than they favored the 10. They liked the 1011. And a beautiful airplane.
You know, I had no idea of the amount of money that it must cost to certify an airplane with the number of trips and so on. Do you have any idea?
Oh, golly. I don't know exactly how many hours they have to do it for certification. But I learned when I viewed that video about the water cells that they put in the fuselage, the cabin, rather. And they changed the water from one location to another to change. And you heard in that audio portion about how they changed the center of gravity of that airplane by shifting the water from one compartment water chamber to another chamber. And it's pretty neat. It's good to watch. It's about almost 30 minutes long, the promotional video.
Okay, Dorothy and Neil, do you have any further announcements or items that we should bring before the group here, even regarding future shows?
Dorothy?
Yes, I do. I do. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Jim. Jim, glad to have you back.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Look forward to seeing you again soon. I want to welcome Neil, and I would like to welcome a new member, John Lundblad, tonight. He joined us November 24th. He says he's 42 years old, CVG. I have yet to figure out what the CVG means.
Columbus, Georgia, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. Or Ohio, I don't know.
That could be. We hope you're listening tonight, John, and we thank you for joining our membership.
That's Cincinnati.
Oh, all right.
Is it? Okay.
Our sponsor, Reefer, don't forget to go to their website to check on their new upcoming 48th Annual Reefer Convention at the Francis Marion Hotel in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, That's going to be going to be on September 4th through the 7th. So check the ReBAOnline.com/ReBAnews. Also, don't forget the Silver Liners are having their convention at the Wyndham Grand in Jupiter, Florida, Harborside, May 15th to the 18th. And we'd like to keep those two on the board so that everybody is aware of what's going around with our Eastern name. Also, now we have, remember, this is a time of year when you're buying gifts, and we have Neil's book, Wings of Man, Many, for sales, as well as a selection of, we have Ken Allen, his book is up there, and Colleen Pettit, and we have Sharon Meunier, and we have George Jen, his book is up there. Everybody should take a look at that one, too. In addition to several other hosts that we have had on the show, and great time of the year to be purchasing their books. For our new upcoming episodes that we plan, December 7th, we plan to have a date which will live in infamy, and everybody is quite aware of what that means with President Roosevelt's address, so be sure to join us for that one. And following that, on December 11th, we have Eastern and Air Force One. That will be another great one. And the following week, December 18th, we originally had one that we were going to talk about aircraft, but Neil would like to have an open up mic. So what we're going to do is have open mic, and we're going to let's talk Eastern. We have... the topic will be open to all our hosts and listeners, and to discuss the present changes that occurred recently with the Eastern Airlines Group and the canceling of their .AOC. And we'd like to hear all your thoughts and your views on seeing our beloved name that will once again no longer be seen in the sky. So tune in so we can hear what you think about this and all of your views on the subject. The website is open for everyone to take a look at. It has a lot of new, interesting news, of course, like we talked about tonight, in addition to a lot of comments that have come in on different programs on the DB Cooper and some of the other programs that we've had. So please remember to go to the website, take a look at it. We have it just for all of you, and we want to thank all of our listeners and all of our Eastern family for supporting our show. Thank you so much. Back to you, Neil.
Okay. Emory just showed me a picture of L-1011 still flying in the air. And it's being flown. The original Stargazer is and it's flying, still flying. So anyhow, the airplane's still in the air, just like the DC-3. I don't know how DC-3 will never be shot down. It's going to be around for a long, long, long time. So at any rate, here's the next sound we're going to hear is a 1011 landing, and then we're going to give it over to Jim Hart. But here's the landing.
400. Three, 100, 200, 100, 50, 40, 30, 20, 20.
7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 344 will be taxiing from the gate with another adventure. That's our show for tonight, and we thank all participating in tonight's broadcast. With this, we take a line from Garrison Keller's Lake Wobegon, where all the women are unequaled, all the men are good-looking, and all the children and grandchildren are above average. Until then, we say good night, Eastern family. We love you. Good night.
We love you.
We love you, Eastern.
I'm going to change that. I'm going to change that paragraph around for you, Jim. Next time you're going to read it like this. Where all the Eastern women are unequal, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and the Eastern grandchildren are above average. And until then, we say good night.
Family. We'll remember. Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
We love you, Eastern.
Lots of fun. Thanks so much.
We love you guys, too. Good night. I'm still holding in case somebody had a question.
No,
you're welcome.
We're fine.
Okay, thank you.